You might want to grab a drink and sit down for this episode because things get deep. Today I was joined by my good friend Taylor Foreman. Taylor is a writer from Louisiana based in LA who I met through Medium. He writes about topics like creativity, writing, personal growth, and his articles are always verging on philosophical yet scattered with wit, which is why I love reading his stuff. In this episode, he tells me about his experience at a meditation retreat. We talk about the healing power of out-of-body experiences, our modern detachment from mythology, and the power of storytelling. He also shares his career journey, and we find some common ground in our belief that working in traditionally blue-collar roles can be a great predictor of career success. I hope you enjoy. Here's Taylor Foreman. Hi, Taylor. How are you?
Doing well. Good to hear you, Laura.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to speaking to you. How was the retreat?
Life-changing, I would say. It was a pretty strange experience all around.
Tell me more. Tell me, like, what was the vibe? Like, where was it? What did it entail? What did you have to do?
Well, I guess, I mean, that was my pause, was because I was trying to think how to begin. But it kind of starts, I was in LA and things are weird because of the pandemic. And I thought to myself, what would I do if I could do whatever I wanted? And I realized that I would be traveling. And so I said, okay, well, I need to get my dog to my family and then I can go wherever, because I write. And so that I don't need to be anywhere specifically unless like my pilot starts getting made. So, and I can always fly back for that if that happens. So, I decided to go to Germany. So in the meantime, I had already planned to do this meditation retreat. And so I was like, okay, great. With me and my dog, I'll drive from LA to Denver, which is about 15 hours. And that's where the retreat was in Denver. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there for a week, had all these transformative experiences. And then I drove from Denver to Louisiana where my family is. And I've been here. My mother's moving out of my childhood home. And so me and my brothers came and we helped her have a garage sale and look through all of our childhood stuff and have all those nostalgic emotions and stuff. And I got to help her with all that. But rewinding a little bit back to Denver, I was also randomly selected to be in the research group. So they, it was 1,600 people altogether, and only 30 of us were chosen to be in the research group. And what that means is they took my blood, they took my saliva, they measured my brain waves before and after. And they're going to be following up with me for up to a year post the event. So the crazy thing about these studies is that you can look them up. These meditation retreats are creating extreme transformations in people. And so these scientists are starting to get more and more interested. So we had neuroscientists there, and I got to speak to them because, you know, I was in the research group, and they were the most convincing part of all of this was speaking to them and sort of they're marveling at what's going on and being kind of flabbergasted by the results of doing this type of meditation and this specific way and kind of going deep and having these sort of transcendent mystical experiences similar to like a psychedelic experience, but sort of produced endogenously. So I was hooked up to this brain machine and sort of incidentally, they would pull the brain scanning hats or the caps and they kept getting bigger and bigger ones for me. And finally the scientist put the large one on and she was like, you're the first thin person I've had to put a large cap on. So, I have a gigantic head apparently, but, yeah, when I was little, adults called me big head. So I guess that,
no way.
that was finally proven. So anyway, so, they put like gel in the little thing and they would measure my brain waves. And some people in the research group of those 30 were having, it's really complicated and it goes into deep science, but basically what happens is whenever you go in these transcendent experiences, all the vibrations and all the, wavelengths in your brain and your heart, they've also measured our hearts, for what's called coherence, and all of them seem to sync up in this really marvelous way. And you see these extreme gamma brainwave patterns in people's brains that neuroscientists before events like this were convinced was impossible to maintain for more than a few seconds. And you see people going into these states that look like grand mal seizures. And what it's actually happening is a profound mystical experience that's permanently transformative to the people involved. So, and in a similar sense, if you want to kind of get a feel of how this transforms people, there's psilocybin studies as well that you can look up that are really powerful. It's like 80% of people have complete remission of end-of-life fear and depression and addiction and something insane like that, when in comparison, like SSRIs are like 3% effective or something like that. I might be off about those percentages, but it's something like an insane result from the psilocybin studies. And the thing about the psilocybin studies is that it doesn't have much to do with the chemical, because with people that can ingest the psilocybin and be reactive to the chemical, which is a serotonergic, it binds to the serotonin receptors in your brain and in your body. People can respond to that chemical, but not have the profound mystical experience, which is a subjective experience. And then they, without that mystical experience, they will not have the healing or the beneficial effects. And so that's to scientists, that's groundbreaking, and so it's so groundbreaking that we'll be unpacking it probably for the next few decades, because a subjective personal experience is the only factor that seems to matter in these studies, and so there's no way to objectify it. That's really, really strange in terms of science. So anyway, that was all to illustrate the point that you can manufacture these mystical experiences in your own brain. Your brain creates, or more specifically, your pineal gland produces melatonin, which can be derived into chemicals like DMT, which if y'all know anything about psychedelics, that's a powerful psychedelic. So your brain kind of produces endogenous psychedelic chemicals and you can sort of induce a mystical experience on your own with the proper signaling. And of course you can, if you think about it, because these, you know, when you take mushrooms, it activates parts of your brains that are there. I mean, why would we have these receptors if we couldn't create them endogenously? You know, the mushrooms are sort of just simulating something that we're born to do, and we've somehow lost touch with, you know, that's me kind of theorizing about what happened and why it's not a more regular part of life in modern people. But anyway,
yeah, that is really, I hadn't thought of that actually. Like, why, that is so true. Why would we have those receptors if we weren't supposed to use them? And maybe there was like we just inherently were designed to manufacture that chemical ourselves.
I believe that that's true. And I believe that we do it anyway. I sort of, your body is sort of replete. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's full of DMT, meaning that you sort of hallucinate your reality. And there's sort of dials that can kind of turn that up or down. And you have sort of our human history is a mythic one. It's a storytelling and mythic one more than modern people like to admit or are comfortable admitting. And things like rites of passage for boys, or, you know, vision quests and things like that have been part of humanity for all of our revolutionary history. And having these profound mythical moments where you sort of transcend your body and touch the divine with these, not maybe perhaps not with these chemicals, but sort of signaled by these chemicals in the same way that anxiety is signaled by cortisol or something like that. You transcend yourself and you get a greater sense of meaning. And meaning, we are meaning and aiming seeking creatures, or we're meaning seeking and we're aiming creatures. So you can't, we have legs and we have eyes that are pointed forward, and you can't really do anything if you're not sort of creating a goal and moving towards it. It's just sort of, it's built into our neurology and our biology. And so without these mystical experiences in our modern lives, we've kind of gotten rid of them because they're inconvenient to explanation. They're inconvenient to modern materialist, you know, reductionist things, ways of thinking, that it's a very, very powerful way of thinking because you can break things down into parts and understand them. So I'm not degrading that at all. But what's happened is that we've lost this sort of ineffable experience. And now you have sicknesses of despair. And this is the greatest epidemic that we're facing possibly ever. I don't know. That's hard to quantify. But you see like depression, anxiety, suicide, obesity. I don't know if I've left anything out there, but there's all these sort of internal sicknesses of loss of meaning and despair. And they're all deeply related because it's people being sort of existentially lost, and without a greater meaning to their lives, they sort of fall into this short-term pleasure-seeking nihilism. And we don't like to talk about it, but it's so rampant. I mean, we're all aware. I mean, you probably have someone in your family that struggled with addiction. And so have I. I've lost a brother to addiction. And we think of it, we've sort of normalized it to ourselves, but it's quite odd because we're the only creature that does things like that to ourselves. And so what's missing? Well, part of it is that we've become so powerfully cognitive. Our cognitive capabilities are so powerful that we can sort of turn them in on ourselves and sort of destroy ourselves from the inside out. But we don't have to. And the way to kind of mitigate that is to have these mystical experiences that are sort of necessary for our well-being and our health. And so that's what's going on at these meditation retreats, I think, coming back full circle, is people are sort of, in speaking to my personal experience a little bit more, because I know I kind of tend to get philosophical, I saw people, men in their 70s, that was the most touching, having mystical experiences. We would be in this big auditorium, 1600 people, and we would all be meditating. And it would be a guided meditation by Dr. Joe Dispenza, who's written books and stuff, and he would be doing the meditations or guiding us. And the music would be playing, and then occasionally, like popcorn, people would pop. They would start having a mystical experience, and they would scream or fall out of their chair or whatever. It would be sort of an overwhelming experience where they couldn't stop themselves from doing something like socially embarrassing because it's so overwhelming. You know, it's like being hit with a massive dose of DMT very suddenly. And a lot of energy gets released all at once. And I heard a weeping and crying and laughing sound of a 70-year-old man. And you could tell by the sound of his voice, you know, you knew that man has probably never done that in his entire life. He's probably been repressed and hurting and unable to express himself for his entire life. And there he goes. And afterward, he's a completely different guy. And a lot of his chronic illnesses are just evaporate. And it's like, is that magical? It's like, no, it's really simple. It's just like, we're holding on to this stuff and we just have no release. We're just caught in ourselves and we never seem to notice that we're much larger than our tiny little bodies and our egos and our stories. So it was really touching to hear, you know, an old man like that kind of have an experience and be like, wow, my life is just beginning. And it's like, wow, okay, cool. Another guy, Rob, who was a divorcee, kind of lost, he wasn't super like spiritual or like one of these type of people. He was just like, I just got divorced and I don't really know what to do with my life. So he came to this retreat and I sat next to him on like the second day. And he was just kind of like, you know, he was just a middle-aged guy, just like a dude, you know, like, what do I do with myself? I'm just a little bit like a sad sack. And so during the meditation, he popped and he was like having a blissful mystical experience. I could hear him. And it kind of made me have one, like, because his energy was so powerful that I started to go into it. And the guy behind us started going into it too. And this guy's name is Chase and he was an actor from LA. But Rob was kind of the catalyst for all three of us. And so afterwards, he was different. Rob was different. His eyes were glowing. Like he looked like a new person. When he would talk to me, a 40-year-old man talked to me, another man, grabbed my hand, was kind of looking at me in the eyes and telling me how his life meant something to him now. Like I just don't talk to men like that. That's really profound to me. And he was just, I was walking down the hallway and I saw him staring out the window and I was just like, Rob, what's up? And he kind of looked at me like kind of dreamy. And he's just like, man, I just feel like I have my life back. it was crazy, you know, just this guy, I don't know, that really struck me. Rob really struck me. I couldn't stop talking about him. And so it was that sort of thing. And yeah, so I guess to just like wind down and let you kind of process or ask questions, I have been meditating since then and sort of having my own experiences and kind of integrating into my life. And these thoughts that I'm sharing with you are just some of the ways that I've been processing it or just trying to explain it to myself. So yeah, there you go.
I have so many questions. To break it down, when someone's having this experience, it looks to someone on the outside like they could be having a seizure, or like they're just not, their mind's just detached from their body for a second. Yes. What does it feel like when you're in it? Like, what do you see? Do you see anything? What do you feel? Or does it vary from person to person?
It does vary from person to person, but there are what I would imagine as, and this is very kind of frontier. I don't think anybody really knows what's going on, but I would imagine that you start to see what would be considered like archetypal realities that because modern people are so confused about this. And so it's hard to talk about a little bit, but you know, and I'll swing back to the mystical experience, I promise. But just to kind of illustrate a point that modern people kind of laugh at, say, like the Greeks, for example, who believed that Mars was the god of anger. It's kind of a silly concept to us. But if you think about it, Mars personified as anger, it's like, who's older, you or anger? And what happens when anger takes you over? Do you have control or is it anger? What happens when you fly into a fit or of rage and like when a warrior goes to battle and that rage takes over and kind of guides them? It's like, well, what is that? It's like, is it better personified as a god who is immortal, older than us, can take us over, sort of as the same between all creatures? You know, it's like anger is the same as you as it is in me. So it makes a hell of a lot of sense to personify things like that in a mythological way. And we are a mythological creature and a symbolic creature. You can't really escape from it. So that's all to say, when you have these mystical experiences, it is bizarre and sort of outside of what we would consider mundane reality. But you do notice that there are themes that people sort of see the same sort of whatever dimensional creatures. And to me, it's like, I don't know if that means that there are like literally interdimensional creatures that are like energy beings or whatever, or if it just means that we're tapping into sort of a collective unconscious and we see sort of the same creatures because we are a symbolic creature and these symbols are ways for us to process higher states of reality. I don't know. I'm kind of like, I'm losing track of what I'm saying, even like, because it gets into a strange territory. And so all of that to say is that you have visual mystical experiences that are quite bizarre, that are quite hard to describe, and bodily experiences that you think are completely the answer. You know, my body would convulse and sort of, I would feel energy move in and out of it, and energy that was stuck for however long would move, and it would hurt and it would be scary, and I would move in ways that I didn't know I could. And I don't, it when that sort of thing happens to you, I just sort of lose interest in this idea of like, what is reality and what do I need to like explain or prove myself to people? Because it's like, well, I just had this experience that's completely ineffable. And it felt realer than anything I've ever sensed or experienced in my ordinary life. And so I'm just like, well, that was real to me. And so that's all that really matters to me. So you do have visual experiences, to be more concrete with your question. You have bodily kind of movement experiences of feeling like energy moving through your body. And you can lose track of where you are and who you are in time. And so everything kind of, time bends and warps, and space can kind of bend and warp. And you sort of become everything happening at once. If that's a strange way of putting it, but it's one of many that makes a little bit of sense.
Have you read the book by Yuval Harari, Sapiens?
Yes. Yeah. That was a kind of a transformative book for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible book. So he talks, it's just what you're saying is really reminding me of something that he talks about, which is, so he says that, okay, I might butcher this explanation, but I'll do my best. So there are, you know, there's loads of different types of species that, like humans, are social animals, but mm-hmm. humans are the only species that evolved to be able to live in huge communities of, like, there are billions of humans in the world right now. There aren't, you know, other, you know, we can live in nations and exist as nations, and we've created these huge groups that we can live in. And he says the reason why humans can do that is because we have the ability to imagine. And it's thanks to our imagination that we can create these stories mm-hmm. that create social constructs that we all choose to believe in, well, subconsciously choose to believe in, I guess, or learn, just accept as real. And that's what guides our ability to exist in these huge communities. And so I'd be really interested to know whether other animals can have these experiences, because maybe those types of experiences in the past were conducive to our imagination, because you're seeing things that, you know, you haven't necessarily seen before. It's not within your conscious control.
Yes. Yes. As much as I can remember Yuval's book, and I know that Yuval's a genius but I think that I separate from him a little bit. I agree with basically everything he says, except for the implication that all of this is sort of a social construct or sort of arbitrary, in the sense that the story could be something else. Because I think, like, I tend to be more of like a Jungian or a Joseph Campbell, and all that means basically is that they notice that stories look the same no matter where you go. And so there's a African, you know, great flood myth, and then there's a South American great flood myth, and so on and so forth. And every place has sort of come up with these same stories. And you can kind of dive deep into that. Like, dragons, for example, appear in every culture. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Well, dragon is sort of the personification of fear. And it's like, well, why? Because dragons are a sort of a mixture of all human predators, birds, snakes, like alligators, and like big cats. They're sort of a mixture. They're like a bird, snake, big cat. It's like they're a mixture of, they're like, they're predator as such. And this is sort of a Jungian idea, I guess, but it's like, so that's like the archetypal idea of predator or thing to be afraid of. And so what does that mean? Like, why does, for example, a dragon guard treasure in like The Hobbit, for example? It's like, okay, well, in your personal life, like Laura, for example, like, what are you afraid of? And it could be, for example, that you're afraid of being embarrassed by putting your thoughts out there, is something that I share with you as a fear. And to us, that could be a dragon. It's sort of predator as such. It's this sort of unknown type of fear of us putting ourselves out there and being socially outcast because we say the wrong thing. And like, maybe we'll starve to death. You know, that's like kind of what your limbic brain thinks. And so that's sort of our dragon. It's like, well, the dragon sits on top of the treasure because exactly where our fear is where the reward is. And so, we're Bilbo Baggins. We go towards the dragon, even though we're afraid. You see, we're not like great muscular heroes. We're Bilbo. We're afraid, but we go anyway, and that's courage. Mm-hmm. And if we do that properly, then we get the reward, which is, you know, things that we've seen because we've been courageous in that way. You and I have seen it. And so that's amazing, because that to me says, all right, well, these stories aren't, you can't really like change them. You can change them, but it's like they are sort of universal in this sense, and they are applicable to us. And that the reason that we're so obsessed with story is because we deeply and genuinely need them as reminders of what matters to us. And so, okay, all that to say is like Yuval, I think, can tend towards being a social constructivist, and just meaning that he thinks or maybe implies that some of this stuff is arbitrary or could be other things. And I could be wrong that he implies that. I don't know. But I tend to think that these stories tend to stay the same, and that they're archetypal and universal, and we see them because they're built into our biology. And so, yes, we these stories unite us, and you and I can bond over Harry Potter. But Harry Potter is an archetypal story that's kind of built outward from our biology. And so when we have these visions, we have dreams, for example, they can be archetypal. And when we tell them to other people, it can make sense and they can mean things symbolically. And the same thing happens with these mystical experiences. They can be sort of revelatory in the sense that they're telling you a story. And if you interpret the story, like I just did with the Hobbit story, you can be like, oh, well, what I need to do is go find the dragon with the gold. You know, it can actually tell you where to go if you break it down. So yeah, that was a long tirade about Yuval.
No, that's really interesting. I'm just trying to figure out, like, well, I mean, I'm never going to find the answer to this, I guess, but it's the chicken or the egg. It's like, because some people say, okay, when we dream, for example, our dreams are a compilation of what we've experienced or what we've seen before, things we've heard before. And so your mind puts it into jumble, you know. How would this be different to a dream? Like, does the external have the power to influence it, or is it completely internal and therefore the outside hasn't affected that part of our brains yet?
Well, this is a little bit beyond my ability to understand, but I have the sense that they're at the base of things, that there's really no difference between the internal and the external. And sort of your internal world is as large as a universe, and it's the largest thing that you can possibly imagine, except for everybody else's internal world. And each of us are sort of at the center of this paradoxical universe that we're each at the center of. And it's like, and then also our external world perfectly reflects our internal world in this weird sort of mystical way. It's not the way modern people think. It's a much more Jungian way of thinking, or a mythical way of thinking. And it's the way that I tend to think, especially after having these experiences. It's really hard to explain. It feels like that to me, like no dream is meaningless. Mm-hmm. I think people want their dreams to be meaningless, or they want their dreams to be arbitrary, but I don't actually believe that that's a thing. I think people see what they need to see. And I think people sort of manifest their external world. Yeah, I'm kind of beyond my ability to understand myself, but it's more of a feeling than a knowing these days.
Yeah, God, it's so complex, but I think it kind of circles back to your point anyway, that like maybe we just don't have to know. Maybe that's the whole point. Maybe thousands and thousands of years ago, meditation was super common and people had these experiences all the time because, as you said, it was a biological need that we were inherently born with. And it's this exact desire that we're, you know, acting on now to search for meaning. That's kind of just, you know, maybe that's the whole point. Maybe we just don't need to know. We should just be more instinctual like other animals and just listen to our inner feelings.
Yes, yes. Well, I think that has a great place in our lives, mm-hmm. because you can't really live your life if you're watching yourself live your life, because then you've broken yourself into pieces and therefore you're not kind of all the way living your life. I mean, that's true to some extent or whatever extent. Mm-hmm. But there's also a place for thinking time where you like kind of discreetly break reality up into bits and you say, okay, well, what's the best thing to do? You know, and that's sort of the scientific process. And that's obviously valuable. It's so valuable. In fact, it's so powerful that we have forgotten that there's any other way of thinking, mm-hmm. because everything that we, that brought us out of the discomfort of survival, like, you know, food manufacturing and iPhones and whatever, it's like, all because of this like cutting up reality way of thinking, mm-hmm. this sort of like materialistic way of thinking. And it's extremely useful and extremely powerful. But when it comes to actually doing things, all of the people who invented all of this stuff were visionaries. You know, they had sort of this mythical way of being in the world. And we sort of skim over that. We forget that. We forget that Einstein was like a dreamer, that Steve Jobs was doing LSD or whatever. It's like, mm-hmm. the people who invented the world that we take for granted were themselves not like us in the sense that they were mystics. They were people who were interested in sort of the stuff that you and I are talking about, the stuff that's sort of ineffable and unexplainable. But I think, like, for example, from a tree's perspective, the entire universe and all of its laws and everything that formed around it conspired in order to create the tree. And that's true. From the tree's perspective, the entire universe was born to create it. And there's no faults and there's no mistakes. It's all being done for the tree. And I think it's easy to see that when we look at a tree, because a tree doesn't sort of have a conscious mind as far as we know. And so, but it's difficult to see when we think about ourselves, because we feel the sense of free will when we experience ourselves as being. You know, you and I are talking right now and it feels like we're making decisions, doesn't mm-hmm. it? And so, but if we sort of decided that everything is being done for us instead of to us, if we decided that the entire universe is conspired for everything that happens, including every minuscule thought in our brains, then sort of that can shift a perspective and it can be like, wow, all of this is happening for me. And I that doesn't happen overnight. I don't experience that as a felt reality at 100%. But every step I get closer to that, it's like life just sort of starts slipstreaming. It's like, good God, like I can just sort of be whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of happens. I don't know. It's pretty strange. And I'm a little bit like a fledgling bird. I'm kind of stumbling through this and I'm talking a lot. Because I'm kind of confused about it all, but yeah.
No, I like it. I like being on the receiving end of this. I'm really curious. Was it, because you named guys that you met during this experience. Would you say it was predominantly guys?
No, I that's interesting. It was predominantly women, I would say. Oh. Yeah, that's interesting that happened. I don't know if that's just a coincidence or what, but, or if it was me looking for me, but, yeah. And most of the time when you're meditating in the meditation room or the auditorium or whatever, the people who are shouting or kind of having mystical experiences, it's almost always a woman. And my thought was, my hypothesis there was that women, are much more open to sort of that side of reality. I think that I think women can be better meditators. I think that they can kind of tap into that universe a little bit easier. Possibly, I don't know. A lot of times when I, like you, for example, I'm talking to you now and I feel like I can 100% be myself and just sort of like tell you what I think I know. And I'm not going to get a lot of ego pushback or judgment from you. Mm-hmm. You're not that you're just going to accept everything that I'm saying, but you can make space for me in that sort of feminine way. Whereas a guy, I think if I was talking to a more maybe undeveloped or maybe thoughtless masculine presence, it's like I'm constantly having to like make adjustments and like kind of battle. Mm-hmm. with an additional male ego that like, if I'm making a good point with you, I don't have to like take credit for it. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't care. Like, it's not really me doing it. Like I don't need, it's fine. Like, and you don't feel that as sort of a threat, but sometimes it's like, I suddenly become aware of myself with men where it's like, I just felt like that was a good point. And now I feel like my ego is taking credit for it because I feel another ego being afraid that I'm taking credit for it. Yeah. And it's like, and then it becomes sort of like a fight, like a little tiny subtle fight. And that can be exhausting. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't figured out a great way to interact with men on this level, unless I'm really close with them.
No, like that's why I asked, because I was curious to know. I think, I mean, to the credit of all men, I guess there is an element of men are generally more socialized to be emotionally more repressed than women. Like women are almost expected yeah. to be emotional. And I think there's also this weird paradox, which is why I love Brené Brown for pointing this out. But for decades or centuries or however long, emotions or being emotional has often been linked to or associated with being weak, let's say. And she talks about how being vulnerable is actually, you know, one of the most important, you know, one of the ways to show courage, because it's not easy to do. It's like you're putting yourself out there completely by being vulnerable. And so I think because we've for so many years thought of being emotional as being weak and men aren't supposed to be weak, there's that. I was wondering whether maybe this kind of retreat was something that, you know, men get to at middle age and think, okay, I like, I'm so emotionally repressed that I need to kind of let this out, kind of thing. So yeah, I was like, I was surprised to know that it was more women in a way.
They talk about a lot of times it's women who discover this stuff, and there's like kind of folklore in that community, like that women tend to drag their husbands to these events, and then the husband is the one that has this sort of breakthrough big experience. And the way that that's explained is that people that have no experience with it can just follow directions and not like be like, well, I've been meditating for all this time and I know this and that and this and that. And they just follow the directions. They follow the guided meditation. They just do what they're told. And then it works because they're not in their own way. And that actually happens enough that people have noticed that it is typically the woman dragging her husband to the thing and he's not convinced, but then he'll have the experience because he's not bogged down with previous notions. So yeah, I don't know exactly what to make of that, but yeah.
That is super interesting. What do you think the motivation for most of these people is to go in the first place?
Well, to this event, it did skew towards people who were ill, like with chronic disease. And that, I think, attracts the scientist as well, because when people are kind of spontaneously healing from chronic disease, and you know, I don't want to make any kind of big claims or anything, but, you know, some of the stuff that you hear, like, I, you know, hear about people healing themselves, and it really shouldn't be controversial, because I, you know, I talk about this stuff with people. People ask about the meditation retreat, and I feel a little bit like a kook being like, well, you know, people heal themselves. It's like, am I gullible here? Like, what, you know, but it's like, I've seen enough where I know that I'm not. And it really is pretty straightforward. It makes a lot of sense to me that people can heal themselves, because how often does an animal have a chronic disease the way that a human being does? And like, why? Well, it's because our minds do it. You know, it's like our minds do it to ourselves. And if you can suddenly get out of the way and like sort of release that kind of chronic energy that, like, you know, restricts blood flow from to a certain organ, or like makes you flex your leg in a certain way chronically, or like whatever, it's just sort of like trauma and like overthinking and repetitive loops, and if you can release that all at once, like, it's like, whoa, all that sort of chronic disease can kind of go away really quickly. And so yeah, to me it's not that surprising that people can heal themselves. And to answer your question, yeah, I noticed it was a lot of people who were looking to heal themselves. And I heard some pretty amazing stories about that kind of stuff.
So on a physical level, not just on like a mental health level, like people with, like, say, obesity or addiction, like you said. Well, addiction, I guess that is mental, but.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, even people with like Parkinson's, or like people with like nerve damage, or like bound to a wheelchair, or even cancer and stuff like that, were there. And yeah, I mean, I like, this is like, oh, this sentence is like dubious to people, but I actually, and it wasn't a dramatic scene, I saw a lady scooting around in an electric wheelchair, and I saw her stand up out of it by the end of the event.
Oh my God.
And it was like, it was just in the hallway. Like, she just like stood up out of it, and nobody was really around. So it wasn't like up on stage and everybody's cheering and stuff. It was just like, she just like was doing these meditations, having profound mystical experiences, and feeling herself as someone who could walk, and finding that that was true to whatever extent. And yeah.
Do you know, it's so weird that you would say that today, because I've just come back from, I spent 4 days with some friends, and one of them had started watching a show, because, you know, Mandy King, the actress from The Office, I don't remember what her name was in the, Kelly in The Office.
Yeah.
So I think she's like written and produced or something, this new show called Never Have I Ever. And apparently my friend was watching it in the car on our way back, and it's supposed to be for like a younger audience, I think. But she was like, oh, this is actually pretty witty. And so I started watching the first episode, and in the first episode, the girl, the main character, it's basically a story about how her dad has just died and she's just witnessed it. So she's like performing in a school orchestra or something. The dad has a heart attack right in front of her, and the trauma of that leads her to like become paralyzed from like the waist down, until 3 months later when another event happens, I don't remember what, but she suddenly has to stand up for something. And so it wasn't physical, but her like during that time she literally could not walk, like she was paralyzed. It's just her mind was telling her body that she was paralyzed, as opposed to her legs not physically or physiologically functioning, you know. And so there are,
yes,
they do explain like some sort of medical explanation, but for the purpose of the show they don't go into detail. But it is like, I believe it. I think there's definitely, you know, that mind body connection.
And the more you dive down into that rabbit hole, the more you kind of see that the line is incredibly blurry. So for example, if you, there's a study of people practicing piano and getting however much percent better after however long, and then another control group doesn't practice, and then another group practices, but not with the piano, just in their mind. They don't even move. Mm. And they get the same percent better as the group that practices with the actual piano. And so physical changes happen in your body and in your brain based on what you believe. And it's like, well, duh, you know, we all know this. It's like the placebo effect is a documented effect. Like we all take it into account when we, mm-hmm. you know, study medications or whatever. And it's like, well, what is that? Yeah. I mean, why don't we think about that? What is that? It's like, well, you make yourself better because you believe that you're better. And it's like, well, what's happening there? And it's like, how far could that go? And what if you took conscious control over the placebo effect? Mm-hmm. And you can. And that's what people do. That's how people are healing themselves. And it's like, well, what are the limits of that? It's like, well, somebody who like literally shattered their entire spine, you know, and has been in a wheelchair for 40 years, maybe they can like move in a way that they've never moved before and like blow everyone's mind. Mm. And maybe they'll never be LeBron James, but like, you know, that's incidental. It's like, well, where are you now? What are your limits and how can you transcend them? Mm-hmm. And that's always the case all the time for everyone. You know, I'm not currently LeBron James, but, and I'm not moving towards those limitations, but like I am finding the outer rims of my limitations and sort of transcending them as best I can in these ways that are surprising and creative to everyone involved. And so is everybody else who's trying to be better. And so, yeah, this like cynical notion that like, that you can't get better, that like your limits are sort of these curses. It's like, it's kind of silly. If you realize it, it's like, oh, well, the whole point of being alive is that we were born into limitation. We were born almost on purpose to experience what it's like to not be the smartest, the prettiest, the fastest, or whatever, and see what we can do to transcend those, because we don't know what the upper limit of that is. As human beings, we do not know what our upper limits are. Our limitations are soft, mm-hmm. and they keep rising. And it's like, well, if you were God, if you were the universe, if you were everything happening all at once, you have no limitation. You are all things at all times. And so why would something like that manifest as us, as consciousness in a human body? And it's like, well, to experience limitation, mm-hmm. the same way we put limitations on chess pieces like pawns to make the game so complicated. There are more games of chess than there are atoms in the universe. Look it up. It's an insane thing, but it's true. It's the limitations placed on these pieces give manifold reality, this sort of impossible limitlessness is born out of these limitations. And the same thing is true for us. We are gifted with our limitations, whatever they might be. And that's not to say that we should accept them and not try to overcome them, but to not be grateful for them at the end of it all, when I think with some wisdom, is kind of silly. Because it's like, well, when we're dead, we'll be everything happening at once and our limitations will be gone. So what are we here for? To dance among our limitations. Because, like, for God's sake, even Brad Pitt is still a monkey in a meat suit. Like, it's, we're disgusting, shitting, dying creatures. And it's like, we're limited to the nth degree. And so what that I'm not Brad Pitt or LeBron James or whoever? It's like, so what? It's like, it's a gift. All of it is a gift. And when I realize that, it's like, oh my God, the liberation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, who am I? I'm Taylor Foreman. Where am I going? I want this, this, and this. Great. What an adventure. You know, mm-hmm. Wonderful.
That's such a good way to view it. You know that I love Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert podcast. He said the other day, I don't remember who the episode was with, but, and I don't remember why, but he just said, like, really quickly in passing, and it really stuck a chord with me, because he just said, yeah, at the end of the day, we're just all a bunch of monkeys trying to keep busy until we die. And I thought it was so humbling, because my sister, my cousin, and I had gone up to a hike in the mountains, and we did this huge hike, and it was just like over 3,000 meter tall mountain. I think it's 3.2K, the actual height of it. And we were stood almost at the top, and we thought we were almost at the top. And then we looked up and saw this tiny red dot, and it was another person. And we realized just how long more we had to go. And when you're on a mountain that size, you completely lose sense of perspective. So something, the peak can look super close, and it's actually going to take you another hour and a half or 2 hours to get there. And it was just, it made me think of this phrase, because it's just so weird when you're in, you know, when you're in a city and you're surrounded by people, it looks like you're just one of a bunch of people. Like, humans are very real in that moment. But then when you're stood in a mountain and there's hardly anyone around, and the next closest person is this tiny dot, you realize like how small you are too in the world. It's like, oh my God, this stone next to my foot, I'm closer to being that size than I am to being the size of this mountain. And this is just one of the mountains in this huge mountain range. And yeah, it's just this idea that the example that you gave with the tree, it's like we think that we are the center of the universe a lot of the time, and that humans are the rulers of the world in a sense. And it's like, God, we're just, like, excuse the pun, but we are just pawns in this world that's just huge.
Yes, that is absolutely and perfectly true. And I think at the same time, there's a paradoxical, just like with the chess game, there's a paradoxical bounty and abundance that you have to totally accept your smallness. Mm-hmm. But then you think, well, the next step I can take is so powerful, I can't believe it. You know, once you accept what you truly are, it's like, well, I'm sort of a manifestation of an information current. Like, the current that is Laura is sort of just information. It's sort of an energy wave, not in like a woo-woo sense, just like in the sense that like all your cells are replaced every 7 years or whatever the, you know, that fun fact is that people say. And it's like, you are more like water flowing through a whirlpool. You are more like the whirlpool itself than you are any of the particles of water. Mm-hmm. And the whirlpool, what is it? Well, it's just a current. It's just information. It's laws of the universe sort of playing out this dance. And it's like, well, that's what I am. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that when I dance properly, when I am courageous and do the things that I'm afraid to do, when my mother dies and I'm there at the funeral and my siblings can cry on my shoulder because I've put myself together properly, and whenever I can support myself, and whenever I'm a good friend and a good neighbor, that my energy ripples outward in ways that I cannot even imagine. And affects people in ways that are so big, it's unbelievable. You know, you affect 1,000 people positively. Mm. and they affect 1,000 people, that's already a million. And it's really like that. You really are sort of the center of this interesting web, and we all are. And every day that you don't show up is a day that the universe misses you. And it's like, that's amazing. That's so amazing. But you can't get there unless you accept your limitation, unless you accept what you said, which is the sort of dust in the smallness. It's like, that's the first step. It's like, great, I'm tiny and I'm a small, I'm literally closer to being this rock next to my foot than I am this mountain. And that is profoundly humbling. And it makes me realize that I'm not who I thought I was. But then you can kind of be like, but my choices really matter. And it really matters that I do the right thing. And my fears, the thing that I'm afraid to do the most is a chance to be heroic. And what better feeling than to be heroic and courageous in life? It's not about being happy. Like, happiness is fine. It's a byproduct. But God, whatever you're afraid of, your biology is trying to tell you, this is the place to look. This is where the treasure lies.
I haven't even given people the backstory. Do you want to tell us, how did you get to be? This should have been question number one, I guess. But no, like, honestly, firstly, I should say, I don't like to say that people were born to do a particular thing, because, you know, I do believe that we can all do a lot of things. But God, like, you were born to be a writer, Taylor. what did your career look like before you became a writer?
Well, I bounced around like a lot of writers. I was doing, I studied philosophy in college. I did sales out of college for a software company, and was writing my books during it. And I worked in marketing for a while. And then I was a handyman when I quit that, because I just couldn't stand it. I was a handyman for a while. And was writing all along. And finally, thanks to blogging and finding good clients and finding writing projects that finally took off, I am sort of a self-sustained sort of business of one / writer. And to me, like, I write TV pilots. I have one that's in production, in development technically, but it's going slow. It's like Hollywood stuff, but I'm really proud of that particular story. And you know, that's a little bit of just like, oh, look, I'm legitimate and like, whatever. But like, I'm proud that like producers were interested in it and whatever.
Oh,
and
God, so it's amazing. Don't downplay this. This is huge.
Yeah. I don't mean to downplay it, because I feel amazing about it. Mm-hmm. I don't have like sort of that lingering self-doubt. I just like, it's interesting to say, because like, it's interesting to say, oh, I have a pilot in development, because I'm not just trying to like, I don't know. Anyway, I haven't given that a whole lot of thought. But anyway, I also have written a book, and I pitched that to agents, and God, I've been rejected on that so many times, but it's a little closer each time. And I have a few thousand followers on my blog, and then I have some clients some that I write for, so some businesses I write for, mm-hmm. And then some that I coach or consult mm-hmm. with, because thankfully I not only am I a creative writer and a storyteller, I also know a lot about business and sales and stuff, thanks to the part of my career that wasn't meant for mm-hmm. me. You know, I wasn't meant to be a salesman or a marketer, but I learned how to do it. And so it is a useful skill, and I kind of share that with people. But I think that it's interesting, because I think that marketing and sales, unless you're twisting people's arms and tricking people and playing a short-term game, marketing and sales done properly is sort of a spiritual act in itself. I think all things are. You line yourself up underneath yourself, and you can't help but sell what you have to offer the world.
Yeah, you actually wrote an article that was kind of, because I feel exactly the same. I worked in sales. I was a big fan of The Apprentice, the UK version. And I was just convinced after university that, you know, after so many years of academia, I was like, okay, I'm done. I want to do something really businessy. And I was convinced that I would never be successful in my career if I didn't learn how to sell. And I mean, I only mm-hmm. was in a sales role for 6 months, but in hindsight, I honestly think that I probably learned most from that role. And the article that you wrote about blue collar is a better predictor of writing success than Ivy League was super interesting, because you talk about the benefits of doing, you know, other non-officey type jobs, not just professional services, and how that can make you a better creative.
I deeply believe that. I do. Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing, I wish I could find the actual story. I mean, I could if I went looking for it, and I might. But there's a Malcolm Gladwell thing where he references some studies where so many firms want to hire Ivy League judges for obvious reasons, because our culture really values that. But when you actually look at the judges' success, which there's markers for success just like any other job, the ones who do by far the best are the ones who have had blue collar work experience on their resume. And so, you know, a judge from Ohio State who didn't go to Harvard, but maybe worked in the service industry, more likely to perform well than the Ivy League judge, all things considered. And also another interesting bit of information is that the Ivy League judges aren't even compared to non-Ivy League judges, and neither of them have blue collar experience. They're both equally likely to perform the same. So we're obsessed with status and sort of education in our culture. And I understand why, and it can be easy to feel insecure that you didn't go to the right school or whatever, but it just doesn't really matter in the final measurement. It's much more about if you can get to the point where you recognize that you're just about as big as the rock next to you as compared to the mountain, that is more important than anything, because a lot of people, Laura, would really struggle to let that into their hearts, to let, you know, it to, because if you want to put, you know, rubber to the road, it's like, try to get someone who's been to Harvard to do a service industry job. It's like, they can't, they cannot do it. And it's like, well, what's going on there? And it's like, well, a motivational structure inside of them is insecure and needs to feel a sense of grandeur in order to feel okay. And it's like, well, if you can train your biology to feel good, even when you feel tiny, to realize that you're powerful, even when you're a speck of dirt, you are a much more powerful being. And that, and like, if you want to make it as a creative, credentials don't mean shit. And that's like as harsh as I can put it, because creativity is one of those industries where it's like, you either move people or you don't. And like, they don't give a damn where you went to school. It's like, it's not like being an accountant or a lawyer where you can be kind of a shithead and go to a good school and do well. And God, like going to a good school, I didn't focus in high school. And so like, I have nothing but admiration for people who made it to a good school. And I think that that's incredibly impressive. But it's just not the only thing. And like, to people who aren't in that situation, it's like, well, you can wake up today. You can wake up today and start being courageous and accept your smallness and realize that what you do matters, and you can accept that all, and you can start doing it today, and you can have whatever you want. And this is true. And I want people to hear this. If you want it, you can have it. And that seems too good to be true. And it seems insane, but it's true. It is true. And it might not come the way that you expect, but you can have it. And the reason that people don't, for the most part, the reason that most people don't is because they refuse to face the thing that scares them the most. And that's what's standing between you and what you want.
Do you know what? I'm so glad that you just said all of that. And I'm about to admit something that I've never admitted before. In fact, I've definitely not admitted it out loud. I think I'm only just admitting it to myself in this moment. Like, because I think I've realized now that you've said what you've said. I mean, I didn't go to Harvard, but I went to the equivalent of an Ivy League school in the UK. They call them Red Brick instead of Ivy League over there. But anyway, so I went to a good university and I always checked the boxes. You know, I did what I thought that I was supposed to do or what was expected of me. And I personally, because my dad's an entrepreneur, and so at home, I had this contradiction of like, for him, negotiations and sales and things like that was super important. So I went into sales, and I would say in hindsight, probably the main reason why I left after 6 months was because I felt less than. I saw all of my friends going, you know, into law firms or into consulting or into accounting or into banks. And, you know, we'd meet up for drinks or whatever. And I felt like I was being judged for having gone into a sales role. And that's not to say I was being judged. I want to be clear, because this was most probably predominantly in my head, mm-hmm. and most people probably didn't care at all what I was doing. But, you know, when you go around the table and you kind of ask everyone what their first job is, I was working at a vending company in the sales department. And it's only with hindsight that I can say that it's probably the role in which I learned the most. But at the time, I felt like I wasn't worthy, like I wasn't doing something important enough. And I mean, that's not to say that there isn't like a right or a wrong, like I'm still going to train to be a lawyer next year when I go back to the UK. I still want to do that. But I am really glad that I didn't actually pursue that path straight out of university, because for me, I feel like a lot of what I did has so far been fear-based. Like I think someone's ambition can come from seeing an objective in front of them and wanting to reach that goal. And so they really push themselves to get there. I, on the other hand, never said, okay, I want to be a lawyer and I'm going to do whatever I can do to get there. I think I would have been much happier had that been the case. I pursued whatever I pursued and did all the things that I did because I felt that I had, you know, the line towards failure was like right behind me. And if I stopped running, I would surpass the line and I'd just fall within the failure category. And I think that these years after university and what I've seen and what I've experienced, sometimes I feel kind of like I'm behind my whole generation because I used to compare myself a lot and be like, oh, this person's doing this, this person's been promoted, this person's got married, this person's got pregnant and whatever. And this detachment almost has actually helped me. And I'm grateful mm-hmm. now that I'm going to become a lawyer, that isn't my be all and end all, because I've had these other experiences. And also, just because I'm going to become a lawyer doesn't mean I have to stop being a writer, doesn't mean I have to stop doing the other stuff that I've had time to explore and realize that I like. So yeah, I'm really glad you said what you said.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that it was received. So thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that. And it's funny because we're so constricted, so many of us, and it's nice to see a lot of people loosening up. It might just be in our circles, but it seems like people are sort of waking up to this idea that money is really everywhere and that there's no race. The name of the game is really sharing love with people. God, I mean, it doesn't go beyond cliches almost. Like it's hard to talk about without sounding like a Hallmark card, but it's like, well, this is it. It's like, and you don't know it until you feel it. And you'll run around for your entire life having heard these sorts of things, but not feeling them to be true. And so you'll ignore them. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, and it'll hurt you, but it'll only change when you go, wow, this actually applies to me. Mm-hmm. And I feel this as my truth now, because it is, it's yours, you know, and it's all of ours. But, yeah, I mean, and I also relate to your relationship with sales, because I had a very similar thing where it was like, well, literally, I didn't know anybody that could have been judging me, but I still felt judged. And it was like, well, clearly you're judging yourself, buddy. It's like, but I felt lesser than, and I really struggled with it. But I wouldn't trade that struggle for the world. You know, if I went back, I would just like stop struggling about it and just get clear and raise my energy. But like, I'm grateful for however I needed to figure it out, I found it. And the thing is that people listening, wherever you are in your journey, you will hear me saying some things, but other things you won't hear me saying. Because, and it's strange, because like you could listen to this now and not be ready to hear certain things, and then listen to it again in 5 years, and it's almost as if words were inserted that weren't in there before. Mm-hmm. I've had this experience with so many things. It's like, well, for God's sake, people were saying it the entire time. I just didn't have it as my felt reality. And it's you just don't hear what you're not ready to hear. Yeah,
100%.
Well, I was just going to finish by saying words aren't it. Mm-hmm. Words just sort of point to it. You know, we can point to the moon all day, but we can't make people look at the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I've had that definitely with like loads of films, actually. There are films that I know I've watched and then I'll watch them again. Say I watched them when I was younger and you haven't lived certain experiences, so you don't relate to that part of the film and you kind of subconsciously just don't absorb what's going on. And yeah, I've watched it again years later and I'm like, oh my God, like this is exactly, you know, what happened on this occasion, and you relate to it a lot differently based on what your experience has been.
I'm glad you said that, because this is going to sound silly, but I had that experience with The Lion King where it was like, yeah, well, The Lion King is an extremely archetypal movie. It's like based off of like all these old myths, and the reason it's so wildly popular is because it hits these archetypal points like right on the head. I mean, it's a fantastic film and it's really well animated to mm-hmm. to kind of convey all these things.
There's a lot of like hidden meaning, and like now I'm trying to think of any Disney movie that I've watched. But yeah, so it's so interesting. Taylor, I wish that we didn't have to end this, but I feel like it's going to be time. I have so many more questions that I could add to this. You'll have to come back on.
Well, this was a lot of fun. Thank you for your questions, and I really appreciate you inviting me on.
No, thank you. This was delightful.
I'm so glad.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We really hope you enjoyed the episode.
As always, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We love hearing from you. Bye.